Welcome to this podcast from Christchurch London. For more information and resources, please go to christchurchlondon.org.
From Numbers 13 through to 14, the words should come behind me on the screen if you haven't got a Bible or phone with you. The Lord said to Moses, "Send some men to explore the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the Israelites. From each ancestral tribe, send one of its leaders." So at the Lord's command, Moses sent them out from the desert of Paran. When Moses sent them to explore Canaan, he said, "Go up through the Negev and onto the hill country. See what the land is like and whether the people who live there are strong or weak, few or many. What kind of land do they live in? Is it good or bad? What kind of towns do they live in? Are they unwalled or fortified? How is the soil? Is it fertile or poor? Are there trees in it or not? Do your best to bring back some of the fruit of the land." So they went up and explored the land from the desert of Zin, as far as Rehob, toward Lebo Hamath. They went up through the Negev and came to Hebron. Hebron had been built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. When they reached the valley of Eshcol, they cut off a branch bearing a single cluster of grapes. Two of them carried it on a pole between them, along with some pomegranates and figs. At the end of the 40 days, they returned from exploring the land. They came back to Moses and Aaron and the whole Israelite community at Kadesh in the desert of Paran. There they reported to them and to the whole assembly and showed them the fruit of the land. They gave Moses this account: "We went into the land to which you sent us, and it does flow with milk and honey. Here is its fruit. But the people who live there are powerful, and their cities are fortified and very large. We even saw descendants of Anak there." Then Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, "We should go up and take possession of the land, for we can certainly do it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We can't attack those people. They are stronger than we are." And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land that they had explored. They said, "The land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there. The descendants of Anak come from Nephilim. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we looked the same to them." All the Israelites grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole assembly said to them, "If only we had died in Egypt or in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt?" And they said to each other, "We should choose a leader and go back to Egypt." Then Moses and Aaron fell face down in front of the whole Israelite assembly gathered there. Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had explored the land, tore their clothes and said to the entire Israelite assembly, "The land we passed through and explored is exceedingly good. If the Lord is pleased with us, he will lead us into that land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and will give it to us. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not be afraid of the people of the land, because we will devour them. The protection is gone, but the Lord is with us. Do not be afraid of them." That was Numbers chapter 13, 3 to 14. And now, without much further ado, I will welcome Liam Thatcher, the very handsome Liam Thatcher, to the stage. Let's give him a big Christchurch welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. This man speaks the truth. Okay, good afternoon. As Raph said, we are on the 12th week of our series looking at the story of Moses. And if you don't know the story so far, essentially Moses has led the people of Israel out of captivity in Egypt and towards freedom in the promised land. And all the way through the journey, God has provided for these people in miraculous ways. He has protected them from their enemies. He has provided food and water for them in barren places. He has made promises to them, which he has kept, even when they have been horrendously unfaithful to him. And at this point in the story, they have finally reached the edge of the promised land. They're literally a stone's throw away from this place that they have traveled towards for many, many months now. And in the story that we've just heard, Moses sends 12 people, 12 spies, into the land to check it out. And of the 12, 10 of them come back saying, "There's no way we can take this land. The people there are terrifying. We just can't do it." Two of them, on the other hand, say, "What are you talking about? The Lord is with us. Of course we can do it. Let's go over there and take the land." And I find those two responses quite striking. I think they are responses of faith and fear. And what I want to do this afternoon is look at those two things, faith and fear. I want to think about what they are, and I want to ask this question. When we experience fear in our own lives, how can we overcome that fear through faith? I want to look at each of those responses, faith and fear, in turn, and I want to begin with faith. Because I think that we actually often misunderstand faith. I wonder what you would think of if I asked you to define the word faith. Richard Dawkins says this: faith is the great cop-out, the great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence. Faith is belief in spite of, even perhaps because of, the lack of evidence. Faith, says Dawkins, is believing something for which you have no evidence at all, and perhaps even considering the lack of evidence to be a virtue. Is that what I'm commending to you this afternoon? I think actually he has a good point. Because when I hear people talk about faith, I think it often sort of does sound a little bit like that. I hear people talking about faith, and it sounds like this kind of thing that you have and you can muster up and work up in your life, which essentially is like a divine loophole which allows you to close your eyes and ignore any of the big questions of life because I've got faith, I don't need answers. To put it a different way, I was listening to the brilliant and provocative comedian a little while back, Tim Minchin, and in one of his songs called Storm, he says these lyrics: science adjusts its views based on what's observed. Faith is the denial of observation so that belief can be preserved. I'll say that again. Science adjusts its views based on what's observed. Faith is the denial of observation so that belief can be preserved. He says that science is empirical and flexible. That is, science looks at the evidence, it weighs it up, it runs tests, and on the basis of the evidence, it makes certain claims. And if new evidence comes along, science is bold enough to look that in the face and go, okay, we will change our opinion based on the evidence. Faith, Minchin says, is completely the opposite. Faith closes its eyes so that it doesn't have to see anything that would challenge its point of view. Is that the kind of faith that God wants us to have? Or to put it more simply than Minchin does, Mark Twain says this: faith is believing something you know ain't true. I think each of these guys has an important point to make, which is slightly unusual, starting a sermon by quoting and agreeing with three atheists. But I think they have a very important point to make. Because their critique of faith, I think, is very, very helpful. But I would put it to you that what they are dealing with is not faith as the Bible portrays it. And it's not faith as I want to portray it today either. Actually, faith as the Bible talks about is not belief in spite of the evidence, but belief on the basis of evidence. And what they are talking about is not really faith at all, not as the Bible means it, but what's known in epistemological jargon, or philosophical jargon, as fideism. Now, fideism says that essentially faith and reason kind of work in opposites to each other. They can kind of work in hand for a little while, but there comes a point where actually reason can get you so far, but then if you want to answer the big kind of philosophical, metaphysical, moral, or religious questions about life, you kind of have to put reason on the shelf and take a leap of faith. Or actually, Soren Kierkegaard says that it is a circular thing, because a leap of faith is actually a leap to faith by faith. And reason is sort of way over there at the side. Now, I would put it to you that fideism is very different from faith. I want to commend faith to you, not fideism. And what these guys are talking about, Minchin and Dawkins and Twain, is more akin to fideism rather than biblical faith. And like them, I happen to think that fideism is rather absurd. Because if you follow through the logical conclusion, it goes a little bit like this. If you think faith is belief in spite of the evidence, then it follows that strong faith means believing in something for which the evidence seems to point in the opposite direction. That doesn't sound great, right? And the strongest possible faith means being 100% intellectually convinced that something is wrong, but believing it anyway, which is absurd to my mind. So next time you hear someone talk about faith and they say, oh, David Stroud, he's a man full of faith, it's worth asking, what do you mean faithful for deism? Because it might not be as much of a compliment as he'd like to think. I think that biblical faith is very different from what these guys are critiquing. What strikes me about this passage that we've just read is that God does not ask us simply to take a blind leap of faith in spite of the evidence. Rather, the first thing he does is tell Moses to send them out to gather evidence. Read the passage. It says, "The Lord said to Moses, send some men to explore the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the Israelites. So at the Lord's command, Moses sent them out from the desert of Paran. When Moses sent them to explore Canaan, he said, see what the land is like and whether the people who live there are strong or weak, few or many. What kind of land do they live in? Is it good or bad? What kind of towns do they live in? Are they unwalled or fortified? How's the soil? Is it fertile or poor? Are there trees in it or not? Do your best to bring back some of the fruit of the land." This is empirical study. He sends them out to get evidence. Check out the land, the people, the fruit. Literally bring some fruit back so that we can actually taste and see whether the Lord is good. They search for evidence to determine whether or not they have reason to trust in God's promises. This is empirical study. They spend 40 days in there. They check out the walls and the defenses. Neither God nor Moses expects the people to start fighting a battle blindly. Rather, he says, check out the evidence first. Find out if you can fight this fight, and then on the basis of the evidence, choose to trust me. And this is what faith is. When we talk here at Christ Church, when the Bible talks about faith, I think it means not belief in spite of the evidence, but belief based on evidence. And the best way to build faith is not to disengage your brain or close your eyes to reality, but rather to feast your eyes on facts. That's the best way to build faith. If you're exploring Christianity right now, maybe you have a ton of questions about faith, about the claims of Jesus, about what we do here on a Sunday. And I want to encourage you to explore those questions sincerely and to search for answers. I'm not interested at all in anyone disengaging their brain and swallowing a whole load of lies. God gave us minds. I think he would like us to use them. I think it's perfectly reasonable for you to ask questions, to explore questions, to search for evidence, to look for answers. And one way that you may find it helpful to do that is through a course that we run twice a year. It's called the Alpha Course. It's run right throughout the world. Millions of people have done it and have found it an incredibly helpful way to do just that, to explore the evidence and make a decision for themselves. Our next course starts at the very end of September. We have two launch evenings, which you may find interesting. On the 29th of September, we have Emma Jones, who is an entertainment correspondent for the BBC and Grazia, and she's written for Independent and various different outlets. And she's going to be talking about how faith has made a difference in her life and in the world in which she works. That may be of interest to you. On the 28th, there's a talk that I think may be of particular interest to many of you. Professor Tom McLeish, who is a professor of physics from Durham University, a fellow of the Royal Society, he is coming to speak on the question, has faith, or has science rather, replaced God? I know that's a question that many of us wrestle with. It's not a question that we have to avoid. We can ask, we can search, we can find answers. You may find this a really helpful way to do that. All the information is on the website, christchurchlondon.org/alpha, or there are tons of these flyers around at the end as well. Check it out. Explore the claims. No one is asking you to take a blind leap of faith. Faith is built on evidence. And incidentally, at the end of chapter 14, we didn't have time to read it, but if you read through there, I find the ending of this story fascinating. Because after God says to the people, having been disobedient, well, all right, you will now not enter the land, what do they try and do? They kind of work themselves up into this frenzy of faith, and they attack anyway. That sounds more like the blind faith that Dawkins and friends were critiquing, and it doesn't end well for them. Their blind faith, or as Moses puts it, presumptuousness, ends with many of them dying in a battle that God never asked them to fight. That's not faith. Faith is belief because of the evidence. And the greatest way to build faith is to feast your eyes on facts. Now, we'll come back to faith later on in the talk, but I want to look at the second response in this passage, which is fear. I don't know what you think of fear. I mean, it's not a great thing. In many ways, actually, fear can be a good thing. Fear can do good things. It can stop us from making stupid decisions. It can keep us out of harm's way. Sometimes when we experience fear, all sorts of responses and reserves come out of us that we didn't even know we had within us. In the short term, fear can be a good, helpful thing. But in the long term, when we allow fear to shape us, it can be a deeply debilitating, dangerous thing. Fear can do all sorts of things to us that are unhelpful and unhealthy. Here are just three things that happen in this passage. Firstly, fear robs us of the best. How many times have you not done something you actually did want to do because of fear? How many times have you looked at something and thought, you know, I know I'm meant to be doing that, but I'm scared of what it will cost. I'm scared of the pain. I'm scared of the challenge. Therefore, I will settle for something else. Fear does that to us. The people at this point of the story are in a place called Kadesh, and there's a map in just a second. It's sort of on the top right of that section. Kadesh was right on the edge of the Promised Land, and it was actually the most fertile part of the Sinai Peninsula. So it was a good place to be camped. Lots of grass and fresh fruit and all sorts of things. It was a fertile place. The spies go over into the land, and they come back, and 10 of them say, well, it is a good place. It is flowing with milk and honey, but it's going to be painful. It's going to be difficult. Why don't we just stay here in Kadesh? This looks all right, doesn't it? I think I can relate to that. There are many times in my life where I look at things and I think, yeah, I know I'm meant to be there. I know I'm meant to be doing that. I'd like to be doing that, but it's a bit painful. Why don't I just stay here where it's comfortable? Fear robs us of the best. It causes us to look at second or third or fourth or fifth options, options we'd already discounted, and suddenly they start to seem a bit more appealing because they're easier. It's like the opposite of grass is always greener on the other side. It's more like, how green does grass need to be anyway? I do this all the time. I'm kind of like, I would never do that. I'm meant to do this. Yeah, I'll do that. That's a bit more comfortable. And so rather than crossing over into Canaan in the metaphor, we stay in Kadesh. Fear robs us of the best. Actually, the passage is really quite tragic because not only do they decide, first of all, to stay in Kadesh, then they decide to do something insane. They decide to go back to Egypt. I mean, they say this, if only we had died in Egypt. That would have been far preferable. If only we died in Egypt or in this wilderness, we should choose a leader and go back to Egypt. Fear becomes so overwhelming to the people that they think it would be better off to go back to the place where they had been slaves for many years and to die there in misery rather than risk a little bit and possibly enter the promised land. When I hear people talk about dreams they've had that they've given up on because it was a bit too painful, a bit too awkward, a bit too difficult, it saddens me. Because it's like people kind of have this idea that maybe God has prompted them or given them the skills required to do something, but then they kind of just drift back to Egypt, giving up on their dreams. It saddens me. It's such a waste. It saddens me when I catch myself doing it, and I do it all too often. A little example. A couple of days ago, someone asked me if I would do something that for me was a bit out of my comfort zone. They sent me a message and said, would you consider doing a live radio interview on a particularly sort of controversial topic? And my first thought was, no. no way. I know some of you guys, they do this all the time and, you know, way braver than me, obviously. But I just thought, no, I'd be awful at it. I can't do it. And I thought, actually, I should get a second opinion. So I called Andy Tilsley and I asked him and he said, Liam, you're right, you'd be awful at it. No, he didn't, but he's not here to defend himself. Actually, to his credit, he was really helpful, and we talked it through, and actually we came to the conclusion that it would be best for me not to do it for various reasons and that we should turn down the opportunity. But he said this to me. He said, it may well be that turning down this opportunity is the right thing to do, but let's not let fear be the deciding factor. And that really struck me, because I didn't think that Andy had that kind of wisdom in him. So I said to him, well, what Hobbit are you quoting right now? It was all his own work. But it struck me for another reason, a more serious reason, because it made me realize just how easily I default to fear. How easily I'm like, yeah, Kadesh will do right now. I don't need the promise. I'll just stay here where it's easy, where it's comfortable. I do that so easily without even thinking about it. I don't want to live like that. I don't want to live full of regrets because I decided not to do things based on some fear. Actually, I didn't take the opportunity for various reasons, but I realized I didn't like that response in me, and so I've now gone out and tried to find myself a way of confronting that fear in a different way, which I will hopefully do over the next month or so. If it goes well, I'll tell you, and if not, we'll never talk of this again. But the point is, I do not want to be ruled by fear. How about you? Are there areas in your life where you know fear is shaping you? Are there dreams that you have had for many years that you've given up on? Maybe you've settled in Kadesh or you've returned to Egypt. Maybe God has prompted you to do things. You've known in your heart, I should do this. I should have that conversation. I should move in this way. I should take this challenge. But you haven't for whatever reason. Do not let fear rob you of the best. To quote the wise old wizard, let's not let fear be the deciding factor. He'll be proud of that, I'm sure. Fear robs us of the best. Secondly, fear distorts our perspective. The guys come back from the promised land, 10 of them. Their thinking is all over the place. They start giving these negative reports, and I don't know if you read them through in depth, you'd find they don't actually make a lot of sense. They're kind of contradictory reports. They said they went into the land and they saw these large people, and they came back and they said, we've seen the Nephilim. Now, if you've read Genesis chapter 6, it talks about these people, the Nephilim, tons of debate about who they are and where they came from. We don't have time to get into that. But what we do know is that they were large and terrifying people. And so these guys come back from the land and say, we've seen the Nephilim, we can't go in there. Which we know can't be true, because in Genesis 7, all the Nephilim get wiped out. So whoever they did see, they didn't see the Nephilim. They may have seen their descendants, the passage says that, but something seems to be going on where their perspective is being distorted a little bit. And then they say these words. The land we explore devours those living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size. Now that seems somewhat contradictory to me. You cannot live there. It's a dangerous place. It devours everyone. Everyone who lives there is healthy and giant. It kind of doesn't seem to fit. And there's all this wonderful fruit. Oh, and the land devours everything growing. No, it's a contradictory report. It makes no sense. It seems that fear has got the better of them and has twisted their vision of what is actually truly before them. And what's interesting is that the people actually give two different reports in the passage. First of all, they come back and they give a general report about the land, verses 27 to 29. Then Caleb and Joshua get up and they say, don't be silly, we can take this land. And then they come back with a second report, which is actually listed as a bad report. And the commentators point out that word translated bad actually means falsified. So the second report they give is actually full of lies. And it's that report that really has the most details about the land and the people in it. Fear distorts our perspective. We begin by entertaining lies. We end by promulgating lies. Fear distorts our vision of what is really true. The spies report this. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes and we looked the same to them. This is a classic example of what happens when fear shapes us. We project our own insecurities onto others. Do you reckon they actually went through the land and went up to people and go, hey, do I look like a grasshopper to you? Maybe. I think it's more likely that they were filled with fear, they felt disempowered, and they projected that insecurity onto their enemies. Fear makes us do that. And often, the gulf between what is real and what we imagine can be so tragically vast. When you get to Joshua chapter 2, we have a similar situation. The people haven't entered the land. Joshua is standing there on the edge of the land, and he sends some spies in. And the spies go in, and they find this lady called Rahab, and they talk to her, and she confides in them and says these words, I know that the Lord has given this land to you, and that a great fear of you has fallen on us, so that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. We have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt. When we heard of it, our hearts sank and everyone's courage failed because of you. For the Lord your God is God in heaven above and on the earth below. The spies are convinced that the people in the land think they're like puny grasshoppers. When you hear the perspective of the people in the land, they are terrified of the Israelites. The gap between what they imagine and what is actually true is so, so vast. They have begun believing things that are just the fabrication of their fear-fueled imaginations. Fear does that to us. So many times I find myself not doing something, not taking a risk, because I fear what others might think of me. I look at others and I think, oh, I bet that person expects me to fail. Sorry, I'm not pointing at anyone in particular. I bet that person over there, that person is rooting against me. Or maybe that person's just waiting for me to fail. And then when I do, they'll go, well, I told you, and never give me an opportunity again. And what I do is I project my own insecurity onto them. And it may well not be based in reality at all. Fear distorts our perspective. It enslaves us by helping us to think things that are not actually true. When you are faced with fears, here is one of the best questions you can ask yourself. Do I have any evidence at all for this fear? Do I have any evidence at all for believing this? Just as faith should be based on evidence, so should fear. Do I have any good reason for believing that this fear should shape my decisions right now? Because very often when we stop and we look at the thing in the cold, hard light of day, we realize, actually, it's all up here. And there is no real reason for me to be afraid. Fear distorts our perspective. Thirdly, fear enslaves us. We don't have time to look at the rest of the passage, but you really should. It's an odd, odd ending to the story. It's tragic in many ways. The people are so afraid that they actually start not only believing the lies or fabricating lies, but digging their heels in and defending the lies. They start blaming others. Verse 27, they say this, "We went into the land to which you sent us." And commentators point out that this is utterly different from how they have ever mentioned the land before. Read through Exodus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. They always talk about the land that God had promised. They never talk about the land to which you are taking us. But here they make the switch. And the reason seems to be that they want to put the blame firmly on Moses and the God that he is following. It sounds a little bit to me like Adam. It's the oldest trick in the book. That's what he did right at the very beginning of the Bible. God creates this garden. He says, you can eat from any of the trees, just not that one. Adam and Eve are eating lots of fruit in the garden. And then one day Eve comes along with a bit of fruit from one of the trees and gives it to Adam. And Adam knows it's from the forbidden tree. He eats it anyway. And then God says, what? Didn't you have enough fruit? What have you done here? And Adam goes, well, it wasn't me. It was the woman that you gave me. And it's like a way of just saying, fear overwhelms him. He goes, well, it wasn't me, it was her and you, in fact. And just blame anyone but myself. Fear does that. I often find the times when I get most defensive over something is because I'm shaped by fear. And so I try and blame anyone else but me. Fear enslaves us. Actually, the passage gets even worse, because when Joshua and Caleb stand up and they say, don't listen to these guys, we can take the land, what they do is just horrible. At the end of the passage, the people decide they so do not want to take the land that they try and kill Joshua and Caleb. They try to stone them to death. The enemies in the land literally need to do nothing. The people of Israel, so overwhelmed by fear, tear themselves apart. Fear does that to us. It enslaves us. It causes us to tear ourselves apart. How are you doing right now with regards to fear? Are there areas in your life where you know you should be taking opportunities, taking steps, but fear is holding you back? Are there areas where fear is shaping your thoughts? And maybe you need to stop and take a step back and say, do I have any good reason for believing this is true, or is it all a product of my imagination? Are there areas where you've become so used to fear that you've begun fighting on its side almost? You got defensive, you blame others, you play the victim rather than taking responsibility. Fear can shape us in terrifying ways, but there is an answer. We can overcome fear through faith. And I said at the beginning that we often have a faulty idea of what faith really is. We can often imagine that faith is just this thing that we either have or don't. And if we just work ourselves up into enough of a frenzy, that will be faith and that will carry us through. That is not how faith works. Faith has to do with trust based on evidence. And faith always has an object. It's not just some vague thing. It's always faith in something. When Joshua and Caleb stand up and they say, we can take this land, it's not just that they've worked themselves up into some kind of frenzy. Rather, they have faith in something particular. They say this, the land we passed through and explored is exceedingly good. If the Lord is pleased with us, he will lead us into that land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and will give it to us. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not be afraid of the people in the land, because we will devour them. Their protection is gone, but the Lord is with us. Do not be afraid of them. The reason that Caleb and Joshua responded positively was not because they had disengaged their brains or closed their eyes to reality. They had seen exactly the same things as the other 10 people. Rather, they had put their trust in God. And the reason they knew they could put their trust in God to save them was because he had done it before. The place where they get to is a place called Hebron. In the passage, it says it's a very old place. It had been built many, many years ago. Actually, Hebron, this fortified city, had been built by a group of kings called the Hyksos, who were kings from, can anyone guess what nation? Egypt. The kings of Egypt had built Hebron. And so Joshua and Caleb get in and they think, okay, our enemies are the ancestors, or the descendants rather, of people who God has already systematically defeated. He has gone through and dethroned every one of their gods one at a time. He has thrown the most powerful army into the sea, and now they come up against them again. And Caleb and Joshua think, I've got enough evidence to be able to trust that if God says we can take this land, we can put our faith in him. Having faith that overcomes fear is not about disengaging your brain or closing your eyes to reality, but reminding yourself of all the ways in which God has been faithful in the past and using that evidence to cause you to trust him again. That doesn't mean that we can blindly or recklessly just run into any situation we would like and do whatever we would like, hoping that God will bail us out. That didn't work out well for the people in this passage. But it does mean that when we get a sense that God is prompting us or leading us or guiding us to do something, or he makes a promise to us based on the way he has acted throughout history in our own lives, we can say God has always been faithful. He is worthy of my trust right now. That is true faith. And just before Moses sends the spies into the land, he does this odd thing. I looked at it and I was like, why does he do that? And as I thought about it, I realized how beautiful this is. He takes Joshua aside, only he wasn't called Joshua at that point. It says this, Moses gave Hoshea, son of Nun, the name Joshua. Why on earth did he do that? About to send them into the land and he changes his name. It didn't really seem like the time or the place. I think the reason is this. Hoshea in Hebrew means salvation. It's a good name, right? Joshua means God is salvation. And I think the reason for the switch is because Moses didn't want the people to be any, under any illusions at all that salvation would come through their own efforts. He wanted to know that they didn't just have faith in salvation in some general sense. They knew that God is their salvation. It was him they were to put their trust in. Actually, there's something even just a little bit more beautiful as well. Because Joshua, the Hebrew name, in the New Testament in Greek is translated Jesus. And when we read the story of Joshua, Yeshua, Jesus, in the promised land, for 40 days, facing temptation after temptation after temptation, temptations to go away from what God had called, settle for an easy life, give in to fear. When we read that story of that Joshua, we're meant to think of a greater Joshua, Yeshua, Jesus. And in Matthew 4 and Luke 4, we read a story which is just so similar, where Jesus spends 40 days in the wilderness confronting his fears. And in that story, he goes into the wilderness knowing that God has a plan for salvation. It's tied up in his name, God is salvation. But he knew that that plan for salvation came through his journey to the cross. And when Jesus spent 40 days there being tempted again and again and again to give up God's way, which involved pain, and go for a more comfortable way, he resisted at every point. When his enemy came to him and said, you could have all the kingdoms of the world without any of the pain that following God would cost you. Simply just bow down and worship me. It's easy, it's simple, it's painless. Jesus resisted. He stared fear in the face and he resisted and he journeyed to the cross. In 1 John chapter 4, this beautiful phrase, it says this, perfect love casts out fear. Or even stronger, perfect love drives out fear. And when we look to the cross, there we see the most powerful declaration of love one could ever hope to see. Where the God of the universe stepped down into our world, knowing that we were weak and frail and could not save ourselves, knowing that salvation didn't rest in us, he became our salvation. He gave himself up for us, dying in our place. At the cross, we see the most perfect demonstration of victory we could ever hope to see. Because at the moment where it seemed like Jesus was vanquished, there he dealt with the problems of sin and death forevermore. And when we look to the cross, that demonstration of perfect love, it should cast out our fear. Because when we are afraid, we can know that God has the victory. He has always been faithful. He has never failed or been defeated. And so when we face fear, we look to the cross. We look to Jesus. We don't just work ourselves up into a frenzy. We look to that historic moment. We say God has always been faithful right throughout history, in our own lives, and most definitely at the cross. And that gives us faith that we can follow him. He will bring us through to victory. If you are facing fear right now, look to the cross. Look to Jesus. We overcome our fear by putting our trust in him. Maybe the band could come back up. How are you doing right now with regards to fear? Are there areas in your life where you know? Maybe you came in here this morning already knowing. Maybe as I've been talking, you've come to know. Maybe there are areas in your life where you know that fear is holding you back. You don't have to be held back by it. Put your trust in God. Let his perfect love cast out your fear. Maybe there are areas where you know, actually, God gave me this dream and I've been shying away from it because it's too painful. Don't live like that. You don't have to. Maybe you know there are work situations or opportunities that you should have taken, you should be taking, but for whatever reason, you're held back by fear. You just want to stay in Kadesh right now. Maybe you're heading back to Egypt. You do not have to live like that. Let his perfect love cast out your fear. We've heard this morning already beautifully about shame being taken away, about vulnerability and how that leads to freedom and healing and wholeness. If you know there are areas in your life right now where you need help, you feel bogged down by shame, don't stay like that. Don't allow the fear of what others would think of you to stop you getting help. Trust in the God of grace and mercy and trust that people will be able to share some of his grace and mercy with you. And whether it's through signing up to the men's recovery course or talking to a member of the prayer team or pastoral support team or a close friend or a member of a connect group or whatever, talk to people. Don't be held back by fear. Maybe you're exploring Christianity and the idea of going to an Alpha course terrifies you. Don't be afraid. You get a free meal and at the end you can debunk Christianity if that's what you think. It may just be a great way of taking a step to explore the evidence and see if there is any reason for believing in this God. Or maybe you've been exploring Christianity for a while and you've come to the point of thinking, actually, I've looked at the evidence, I do believe in Jesus, but I'm afraid of what it would cost me to start following him. I totally understand that. I would love to talk to you about that. Come and chat to me at the end if you have any questions at all. Or it may well be that you just have fear about other things, the way the church is changing and what that means for you and where you find your place. Do not be held back by fear. Maybe some of you know today there are opportunities you should be taking, areas where you should be leading, but it terrifies you. Come and talk to someone about it. Look to the cross. Allow his perfect love to cast out your fear. Sam and the band are going to lead us in a song in a moment that talks about trusting God. And as we sing this, I don't know about you, sometimes I find it helpful to have in my mind the very thing that I'm afraid of and to make this sort of song about that kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? Kind of just think, okay, I know that's what I'm terrified of, and I'm not just going to sing these songs in a vague sense. I'm going to have that in my mind and say, God, I will not allow that to shape me. I want you to shape me. It may be helpful for you to do that as we sing. And then at the end, we'll have a prayer team available. They would love to pray and talk with anyone at all. I'll happily pray and talk with you if I can. Let's allow God's perfect love to cast out our fear this morning. Why don't we stand? Sam and the band are going to lead us.
Thank you for listening. For more information or for further podcasts and downloads, please visit christchurchlondon.org.